This is News in Notes. I'm Tony Cox. On today's roundtable, an anniversary of sorts in Baghdad. Plus, should Don Imus be fired for his comments about the Rutgers University women's basketball team? And is an apology from the North Carolina legislature enough to right the wrongs of slavery? Joining us today from the studios of Harvard University is Callie Crossley. She is a social cultural commentator on the television show Beat the Press. Hello, Callie.
Hi, how are you?
I'm fine, thank you. And from NPR's New York Bureau, Robert George. He is a New York Post editorial writer and former senior writer for House Speaker Newt Gingrich. Nice to have you back, Robert.
Thanks, Tony.
Also, Detroit Free Press columnist Rochelle Riley. Rochelle, nice to talk to you again as well.
Thank you, Tony.
All right, let's begin with this. We all know last week Don Imus used some not-so-nice words to describe the Rutgers University women's basketball team. He called them, quote, some nappy-headed hoes. Now, the National Association of Black Journalists responded by saying that Imus should be fired. They joined a chorus of others who said the same thing. Now, Imus initially said people shouldn't worry about, quote, some idiot comment meant to be amusing, end quote, but he did apologize for his comments last Friday and again today, saying, quote, we were kidding around, but that doesn't change it. That doesn't make it any less repugnant. I'm not a bad person. I'm a good person, but I said a bad thing. But these young women deserve to know it was not said with malice. So let me come to you, Callie Crossley. Sorry. Is it a sorry word?
Yes, it is in this case. And, you know, I believe in the power of acknowledgement, so I believe that folks should apologize. Having said that, though, we're talking about a guy who has a pattern of this kind of hate speech. And that's fine for the folk who turn on We've Got Freedom of the Press who want to hear that. But there comes a point when you cross a line. To use your analogy, you said that there was a chorus of people who have spoken out. There really needs to be a tabernacle choir now. I would like to see the University of Tennessee team, for example, say, we don't like it either. We beat them. That's fine. We don't like that voice. I'd like to see those other elite journalists who appear on there with great frequency, including Tim Russert, say, sorry, that's way over the line, can't be there anymore. And then I'd like to see the Sharptons of the world. The Reverend Al Sharpton has said he's going to lead some protest to really focus in on the folks that make the difference, and that's the money people. Bob Raceman of the New York Daily News, sports columnist, put it out there, and he's right. It's about the dollars. The man brings in the dollars. He'll continue to sit there and say whatever hate thing he wants to say until those sponsors have to stand up and say, yes, we like the hate speech and we're going to continue to support it. But I have seen in other places one person can make a difference with those sponsors. So, you know, a chorus of voices talking to the sponsors makes a difference.
Well, you know, Rochelle, Callie mentioned Al Sharpton. And before Al Sharpton does any protesting of any kind, he's going to have, he said he's having Imus on his show. What about that?
Well, that's good for Al Sharpton's ratings. And I think it's appropriate for him to have an opportunity to publicly spank Don Imus. But there is a bigger issue. Don Imus has the right to stand on any New York sidewalk in no pants and make obscene racist comments as long as he doesn't block traffic. But what he doesn't have the right to do is to use public airways to make incendiary comments. And his words last week, I thought, are the equivalent of a hate crime. They incite, you know, some militia kook, and as you know, I'm in Michigan, can use those words to say, okay, he's right, let's grab the gun. Some Strom Thurmond wannabe who didn't father a black child can use those words as affirmation of their actions and say, let's revisit housing deed restrictions and school segregation. An apology isn't enough. It's just not. So CBS Radio and MSNBC and the FCC, which as far as I'm concerned stands for failing children constantly, should be ashamed, and they should not continue to provide him with a forum. They should bench him immediately and permanently.
But you know, Robert, even if he were to be fired today, we all know that he'd be hired again someplace else probably before the week is out.
Well, maybe not quite that quickly. I remember, I think that there would be some kind of cooling off period, and then he would probably get rehired. I think that's true. However, I don't think that this is quite the, as you say, as Rochelle says, the equivalent of a hate crime. However, I think at the very, very least, there should be some kind of a suspension from the radio, whether he could be fired. That's not going to happen because he does bring in too much money. But I think there should be some kind of a suspension involved. And I always think it's kind of interesting, though, that, you know, Reverend Al Sharpton decides that, you know, he, in a sense, becomes the arbiter of what the black community is considered outrageous, and somehow now he's going to invite him on there, and Imus is going to go there, and they'll have some kind of a sort of come to Jesus moment, and that suddenly makes it all right. That is completely unacceptable. I think Callie was exactly right when she said that Pat Summitt, who from what I understand was a long time friend of Vivian Stringer, the head coach of Rutgers, Summitt and Tennessee should definitely speak out and say, you know, that they're insulted as well, because I mean they played Rutgers, and you know they saw them as a competitive opponent, and it's an insult not just to black people, but it's an insult to women as well, that we're talking about women's basketball here, and they're referred to a slang term for prostitutes. I mean, I think it's outrageous.
Let me throw this out there for all of you to consider, and it's about what I consider some of the hypocrisy within our community, and it has to do with this. Clearly, what Don Imus said and did was wrong. I don't think there's anyone that would argue against that. But what concerns me is this: when I leave the studio and get in my car and drive down Crenshaw Boulevard in Los Angeles, or if I drive down certain streets in other cities and I pull up to a stop sign and a young kid pulls up next to me in a Monte Carlo, I'm going to hear bitches and hoes blasted from the radio, whether it's mm-hmm. a black kid, a Mexican kid, an Asian kid, a white kid. And we seem to, for whatever reason, have accepted that kind of disparaging characterization of our people and our women from ourselves, and when somebody like a Don Imus says it, you know, we go crazy. Do you understand what I'm getting at? Either.
I absolutely know what you're getting at, but I have to say that, and everybody on this panel, by the way, has risen up to say that we hate that kind of language and we don't think it's a double standard and it ought to be gone. Those are different. It's all about the money there, too. Those are different sets of folks funding it, but it's still all about the money. But when I look across and see that there are people in my profession, like the Tim Russers of the world, sitting on a show, you know, pretending that they can just have a conversation with somebody who has a pattern of using this kind of language, then I have to speak out in that way. So I'm talking now journalist to journalist. Get off that man's show if, in fact, you don't support what he is saying. That's just not acceptable. I can't change right now what's happening with the folks on the radio except by not buying it, and that's what I do.
Mm. And I think some of us, Tony, are trying to do something about it. But we're in the minority because, as you know, and as Callie said, money is money. But the FCC, which literally has done nothing, really has a greater responsibility here. Although we can be assaulted in our homes or at a car nearby, what they cannot do is allow somebody to have access to millions of people on a regular basis to do the same thing. It's wrong no matter where it is. And we've got to make sure that we reassert some standards so that it can't be wrong anywhere.
Well, Tony, I think you definitely do make a very, very good point in the sense that we hear, whether it's hearing women disparaged in rap or the creative use of the N-word, which we've obviously discussed here a lot. And the irony is that, if you know, 10 or 15 years ago, if Imus had actually said that particular phrase, I think there would be a greater chance of him being sanctioned in the context of radio than there is now, because those words are freer in the popular culture. If it had just been a generic white guy saying this 15 years ago, he would have been would have been really serious in trouble, whereas now we're used to this, and so you know we let it slide as a culture.
Interesting point. You're listening to NPR's News and Notes, by the way. I'm Tony Cox in for Farai today. Just in case you're joining us right now, with me on today's roundtable are Callie Crossley, social cultural commentator on the television show Beat the Press, Rochelle Riley, columnist at the Detroit Free Press, and Robert George, whom you just heard, who is an editorial writer at the New York Post. Let's move on to another apology, this one coming from North Carolina. The state Senate there says it is sorry for the role it played in supporting slavery and Jim Crow laws. The North Carolina House has to okay the measure for it to become official, but it's part of a growing chorus, there's that word again, of we're sorries. Lawmakers in Virginia passed an apology in February, and Maryland just over a week ago. Georgia and Missouri are lining up to do the same thing. Some people really think this is a big, big deal, and some people don't. Where do you fall on this, Robert?
I think it falls into that category of there really, really are a whole lot more important things I would like South Carolina and Virginia and all the, and these other states to be doing in terms of improving the lives of African Americans now rather than looking back to the 1860s. Now, some people are saying that if we can get states to apologize, then that puts people in a better tactical position for later for reparations and things like that. So maybe that if that's an argument down the road, that'll be an interesting to debate that on the merits. I just don't necessarily think that apologizing for slavery changes the material or spiritual fortunes of one black person in the United States of America.
How do you see it, Rochelle?
Well, I agree with Callie that you have to start somewhere, and the bottom line is, while the apology doesn't really mean anything, the road to Reconstruction or any type of repair of the relationships in this country that have led to the way some black people live now starts with an acknowledgement that it began with slavery. But if they don't put their money and their hearts and their work where their mouths are, then the apology is about as effective as the Democratic measures to resolve that the war should stop in Iraq. It doesn't really mean anything.
Callie?
And I would just add, I'd underscore what Rochelle just said, and I would just add that there is a reason that every 12-step program, and they are effective, begins with acknowledgement, begins with understanding what your part was in getting to the point that you are at that point. And then from there, you are able to move to restitution. You're able to be able to see the forest clearly, see through the forest clearly to see where's the path I must go to start to make some improvements in the situation. But it's got to begin with an acknowledgement, and in this case, this is an official one.
Yeah, but unfortunately, the comparison to 12-step doesn't quite work in the sense of the country stopped drinking, to use that phrase. After the Civil War, I mean, obviously racism did not stop then. So I mean, it seems to me that what's going on now in the context of racial relations is, while it's an extension from what happened in terms of slavery, it's a completely and totally different animal at this point.
All right, let's move on to
I would just say that I think he's looking at it a little bit too narrowly, that we're really talking about systemic racism, and the biggest systemic racism was slavery, and now all we have is that watered down version of it in many of our institutions. That's what we're talking about. So I would say maybe folks have stopped drinking, but they picked up some other drugs.
Well, I'd say that the analogy to the 12 America on a 12-step program was very interesting. In the time that we have left, I'd like to hit one more topic if we can, and that's this. Today we celebrate an anniversary of sorts. It's been 4 years since the so-called fall of Baghdad. But in recent days, we've all seen radical Shiite cleric Muqtada al-Sadr renew calls for violence against U.S. troops. You brought up Iraq in your last answer, Rochelle. What lessons do you think we've learned in the 4 years since the apparent fall of Baghdad?
Well, the only people who are learning lessons are Americans, and there are numerous polls, as much as you can depend on polls these days with cell phones, that cite some of that change of opinion. You know, 8 in 10 respondents to a recent poll are worried about the way things are going, and 3/4 of some say that the United States is not doing a good job. The bigger issue is, I don't know what other signs President Bush and his team need to understand that we did the wrong thing, we're not going to make it any better, and we need to get the troops out of Iraq.
A key figure in this today is al-Sadr, it seems, and he's been playing both sides of the fence. What do you make of his most recent reversal, Callie?
Well, I think he's, as we used to say in the neighborhood, laying in the cut.
Mm-hmm.
He also encouraged people to drape themselves in flags and get out in the street and note that this has been going on for 4 years and it's time for Americans to get out. So I think this is just a temporary lull in obviousness, but the fact that he encouraged people to participate in this rally really is where he's coming from. That's my take on it.
Robert, I hear you breathing, Robert.
Well, I mean, the fact is, we lost another 10 men over the weekend, 10 soldiers and Marines over the weekend. This is the fall of Baghdad. You know, has now politically speaking in the United States has led not solely but partly led to the fall of the Republican majority in Congress, and it is, I think, arguably, if it continues in this situation where you're not going to have any real resolution, and al-Sadr, who is aligned with the Shiite majority, if he continues to still have influence, this administration is going to find itself even more isolated amongst the Republican leadership that are in Congress. They'll stick with him for maybe like another 3 or 4 months in terms of getting the current funding pushed through. But I think it's only a matter of time before even they start to move away from him as the 2008 elections start getting closer.
In 30 seconds or less, Rochelle, could you have imagined 4 years ago that the United States would be in this position in Iraq today?
With this president, I predicted it in my column.
Did you really?
Yes, I did. I said we'd be there 10 years.
Well, we're 4 years in. Oof. Joining us today, of course, on Roundtable, Kelly Crossley, social cultural commentator on the television show Beat the Press, Robert George, a New York Post editorial writer and former senior writer for House Speaker Newt Gingrich, and Detroit Free Press columnist Rochelle Riley. Everybody, very interesting Roundtable today. Thank you very much. Be careful what you say.
Thank you, Tony.
Thank you.